Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Our discussion this evening is the time of the Messiah. In the Old Testament, there are a number of materials that tell us about one who is to come and to deliver Israel. The deliverance is spoken of both in terms of dealing with a sin problem and in terms of dealing with the problem of war and oppression and things that relate to that. We'd like to discuss tonight things in this area. From the time of the completion of the Old Testament, traditionally around 400 BC, down to this very time, there had been interest by various persons on this material in the Old Testament about the Messiah. But it's interesting to note that probably there has been no more expectancy for the coming of the Messiah any time through these 2,300 and some years than there was in the first century A.D. During that period, there was a very intense expectation of the Messiah coming. We see this from several ancient sources that come from this period or speak about this period. A fellow by the name of Suetonius, actually Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus, was a personal secretary under the Roman Emperor Trajan. And with his access to the archives of the Roman Empire, he found opportunity to write a history, which he called The Lives of the Twelve Caesars. And in the life of the Emperor Vespasian, section 4, as Suetonius speaks about the events leading to the war between Rome and Judea, a war which eventually, over the course of the period 66 AD to 73, resulted in the destruction of the Jewish nation. He says that one of the reasons for this particular war was that there had spread over all the Orient an old and established belief that it was fated at that time for men coming from Judea to rule the world. This prediction, according to Suetonius, referring to the Emperor of Rome, as afterwards appeared from the event, the people of Judea took to themselves. Accordingly, they revolted, and after killing their governor, they routed the consular ruler of Syria as well when he came to the rescue and took one of his eagles. So here we have a rather interesting feature. Suetonius says, one of the reasons why the Jews revolted against Rome was that they believed in an old and established belief that it was fated at that time for men coming from Judea to rule the world. Another historian of the same period is Cornelius Tacitus. Tacitus is considered a somewhat more reliable historian than Suetonius is, and Tacitus wrote two rather important works, the Histories and the Annals, but we have very, very little of the Histories left. We have a good bit of the Annals. In Tacitus' writing, in his History, Book 5, Section 13, he begins to discuss the revolt of the Jews against Rome also, and he speaks of various things going on here. He says, mentions some omens which he felt were unfavorable to the Jews, and he says, few interpreted these omens as fearful. The majority firmly believed that their ancient priestly writings contained the prophecy that this was the very time when the East should grow strong and that men starting from Judea should possess the world. This mysterious prophecy, says Tacitus, in reality pointed to Vespasian and Titus, but the common people, as is the way of human ambition, interpreted these great destinies in their own favor and could not be turned to the truth even by adversity, and goes on then to speak of the Roman War. So here we have in two of the Roman historians, speaking of this period of the Jewish revolt, 66 AD to 73, that an important factor was some sort of belief, which Tacitus makes more explicit. It was based on a prophecy in the Jewish ancient priestly writings that this was the very time, remember Suetonius said about this time, the East should go strong and that men starting from Judea should rule the world. Now, it just happens that we have a Jewish historian from this period, one who has not been too highly regarded among the Jews because he changed sides in the middle of the Jewish war. He was defending a fortification of the Jews, and when that was taken, he came out and said, you, O Vespasian, will one day be emperor of the world. And Vespasian, desiring to see whether that was true or not, did not put the fellow to death. And as a result, the fellow's life was spared. As it happened, Vespasian did become emperor, Roman emperor, some years later. This fellow wrote a history of the Jewish war himself, writing at a closer time than these two Roman historians. They are writing about 110, 120, so they're writing about 60 years, 50 years away from the war. Josephus, Flavius Josephus, in writing his Jewish War, is writing only about 10 years after the event, and he is Jewish, so he was on the scene to know what was going on. He has this to say in his work, The Jewish War, and the reference here is 4, Book 6, Chapter 5, Section 4. Discussing the events leading into the war, he says, "But what did more than all else incited them to the war, was an ambiguous oracle, likewise found in their sacred scriptures, to the effect that at that time, one from their country would become ruler of the world. This they understood to mean someone of their own race, and many of their wise men went astray in their interpretation of it. The oracle, however, says Josephus, in reality signified the sovereignty of Vespasian, who was proclaimed emperor on Jewish soil." What we see here, then, is that one of the significant causes of the revolt of the Jews against Rome in the first century A.D. was a belief that their scriptures said at that time someone was to come and rule the world. And the Jews certainly would have understood that to mean the Messiah. And presumably then they undertook the war with the idea that the Messiah would arise to bail them out. Now we see in all of these cases, people on the Roman side said, yes, but this passage really referred to Vespasian. But we'll have to look at that a little bit later. I think we can feel sure that the Jews did not so interpret it, this particular event. Otherwise, they would have surrendered to the Romans, not revolted against the Romans. So I think we can see here one reason then, perhaps the reason, why the interest, the expectation in the coming of the Messiah was so high in the first century. There was an understanding of some prophecy from the Bible that somewhere in that century the Messiah was to come. This is further supported by the very little bit of Jewish information we have from this period besides Josephus, found intermingled in the 35 volumes of the Babylonian Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud would be the discussions of the rabbis from back before the time of Jesus all the way out to about 200 A.D., compiled and written down in what we call the Mishnah, which was written in 200 A.D., and then commentary on that worked over and discussed and such for another 300 years, 350 years for the Babylonian Talmud, down to 550 A.D. The result is about 35 volumes in the English edition, as we see here, and amidst that, there are materials regarding the coming of the Messiah. These materials occur especially in the tractate of the Talmud called the Sanhedrin, and on a page in the standard editions, page 97b. Now, in the midst of a discussion regarding the coming of the Messiah, we have this remark by the compiler of the Mishnah himself, a fellow nicknamed Reb, better known as Judah the Prince. So we're getting a viewpoint of the Jews about 200 A.D. He says, "All the predestined dates for redemption have passed, and the matter now depends only on repentance and good deeds." The point, then, is that the Jews understood that there was at least one passage predicting this time of the coming, perhaps more, but that all of them, by 200 A.D., were past. The time had run out on whatever these were. Their interpretation was, well, the Messiah hasn't come, therefore the trouble must be that we need to repent, or we need to do enough good deeds. So we find rabbis saying things like, if Israel would ever keep the Sabbath right once, the Messiah would surely come, or things of that variety. But what they've done is they've apparently taken materials that give some time indication, and when it didn't show up as they understood it, they interpreted it in some other way. Now, our question would be, what passages would there be in the Scriptures that might have given any time indication regarding the coming of the Messiah? Well, there are two passages I can think of right offhand that suggest that certain things would happen around the time of the coming of the Messiah, or he wouldn't come until certain things happened, or things of that sort. One of those would be in Genesis chapter 49, where Jacob gives a series of blessings to his sons, And one of them is a series of blessings to his son Judah. And he says in the midst of this prophecy, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. Now the trouble with that kind of a prophecy is, you can't tell when it's going to be fulfilled until it's already too late, so to speak. It gives you a picture that the kingship will continue in Judah until the one comes to whom the kingship belongs. Now, as we look through the history of Judah, we find that the kingship was in Judah. The descendants of David were in Judah, and they continued to reign until 587 B.C. Then there was an interruption, and not again after that did a descendant of David ever reign again in Israel, but there were two more periods of time in which there were kings over Israel. And though neither of these sets of kings, the Hasmoneans or Maccabees and the Herods, were descendants of David, they did both rule over Judea, which in fact became the name of the southern tribe. And one of these would be the Hasmoneans, a group of kings ruling from about 140 B.C. down to 63 B.C., and then their rule was interrupted. Then the rule picked up again with Herod the Great, no relation to them, but a Jew, in 37 B.C., and that continued down to his death in 4 B.C., and then it was broken again. Then one of his descendants, who was in fact both a Herod and a Hasmonean, ruled from 41 to 44 A.D. This was Herod Agrippa I. He was the last person to rule as king of Judea, and from that time to this, there has been no king ruling in Judea. So here's a possibility of a prophecy which would indicate a time of the Messiah. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. But notice you could not have predicted in advance how that would work. All you can say is since 44 A.D., there has been no king, there has been no scepter in Judah. That presumably would not have been anything that would cause someone to start the war, since would not give the right kind of a time indication. The other possibility is a reference in Haggai, where it said, the glory of this latter house, the second temple, will be greater than the glory of the former temple, and here I will give peace. And the second temple was destroyed in 70 A.D. So that if that is reference to the coming of the Messiah, would indicate that the Messiah ought to come before 70 A.D., but you wouldn't know it until the temple was destroyed and looking back. Neither of those would adequately explain, I think, why there was a great interest in the coming of the Messiah at this time. There's only one passage I know of in the biblical material which seems to give a chronological indicator that you could tell in advance approximately when the Messiah ought to come, and that is the so-called 70 weeks passage in the ninth chapter of Daniel. The passage reads this way: an angel has come to Daniel with a message in answer to Daniel's prayer, and he says, 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city, to finish a transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. So you are to know and to discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah shall be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and proceeds on briefly then to discuss the last week, which has not been discussed up to here. So it mentions a period of 7 weeks, a period of 62 weeks, and a period of 1 week, and it says the time from the going forth of the command to rebuild Jerusalem to the coming of the Messiah seems to be indicated as 7 weeks plus 62 weeks. This passage then is the only one I know of that would seem to give anything by which you could make an advance calculation and make some suggestion on when the Messiah would come. We'd like to look then at this passage in some detail. We want to start, first of all, and look at the background of the passage and see whether the background will give us any hints on how to deal with the particular passage. Then we want to look at the passage itself, and then we want to try and see if we can actually make the calculation. In this passage, Daniel chapter 9, 24 through 27, we find this answer given to Daniel's prayer. Daniel began to pray, we learn, from the beginning of Daniel chapter 9, because of something he had learned. In the first year of Darius, son of Ahasuerus, of Median descent, who was made king over the kingdom of the Chaldeans, the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, observed in the books the number of years which was revealed as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet for the completion of the desolation of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. So I gave my attention to the Lord God to seek him by prayer and supplication with fasting, sackcloth, and ashes. And then we have the beginning of this prayer, a prayer of confession in which Daniel confesses his own sins and the sins of his people and calls upon God to fulfill his own word that he predicted through Jeremiah to bring back the people. Now, there's some interesting things about this passage here. One of them is this, that in verse 2, it says, I, Daniel, observed in books the number of years which was revealed to Jeremiah for the completion of the desolation of Jerusalem, 70 years. What books is he talking about? Well, one book is rather obviously Jeremiah itself. And we see two references in Jeremiah to the time of desolation as 70 years. In Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 11 and 12, we see this remark, and this whole land will be a desolation and a horror, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then it will be that when 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon, and that nation, declares the Lord, for their iniquity in the land of the Chaldeans, and I will make it everlasting desolation. And then over in Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 10, we have a reference that's a little more explicit on the return of Israel in this direction. Thus says the Lord, when 70 years have been completed for Babylon, I will visit you, I, God, will visit you, the Israelites, and fulfill my good word to you to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you, and you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. Some people have often wondered why Daniel, after reading that the prophecy predicted the captivity would be 70 years, why he bothered to pray to God for it? You know, why he bothered to pray to God for return? You know, isn't God just going to do it? No. God says here, when these 70 years have been accomplished, I will visit you to bring you back to this place. Then you will call upon me and you will come and pray to me. So when Daniel saw what he was supposed to do, he did it. And then indeed God carried out his word. We see a picture here of the interaction of God's control of history and yet the responsibility of individuals. I won't try to charge into a full explanation of the matter beyond that. Not that I could, but we'll let it ride there. But we haven't solved one problem yet. I learned by books, he says, that the captivity would be 70 years. But we only find the reference to 70 years in Jeremiah here. What other books are available? Well, there's one other book available, but I highly suspect it was not written when Daniel wrote. That is 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, 21 and following goes on down to the very decree by which God providentially uses his fellow Cyrus to bring the Israelites back. And so it records things, and doesn't say it's predicting them, it records things which occur after Daniel's cogitations. But notice what it does say about the captivity. Here's a picture of the Babylonians here in verse 19, destroying Jerusalem. They burned down the house of God, broke down the wall of Jerusalem, and burned all its fortified buildings with fire, and destroyed all its valuable articles. And those who had escaped from the sword, he, Nebuchadnezzar, carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and to his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah. And then we have this phrase and sentence added that does not occur in Jeremiah. Until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths, all the days of its desolation, it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. Well, that's interesting. Here is an additional piece of information that's not found in Jeremiah, that is found in Chronicles, but it points us to something that's rather interesting. In the passages where God sets up the blessings that would come on Israel for their obedience to his covenant, and the curses that would come on Israel for their disobedience to his covenant, there is one set of material which gives a time of their captivity. And that one set of material relates to the law that the land should keep a sabbatical year every 7 years. Let's have a look at that particular passage. The law requiring that the land should observe a Sabbath year occurs in chapter 25 of the book of Leviticus, verses 2 and following. Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you are come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your fruit, your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard. and gather in its crop. But during the seventh year, the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field, nor prune your vineyard. Your harvest after growth you shall not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. And it goes on speaking of other features about the sabbatical year. You hear about the sabbaticals in connection with colleges these days. Professors go off to do something. But the original sabbatical year was for the farmers, and actually for the land, not for the farmers so much, to take a year rest. Now, over in the next chapter of Leviticus, we have a picture of the penalty for disobeying the commandment of the sabbatical rest, mixed in with the penalties for disobedience to the covenant in general. Verse 31, I, says God, will lay waste your cities as well and make your sanctuaries desolate, and I will not smell your soothing aromas. There will be no more sacrifice. And I will make the land desolate so that your enemies who settle in it will be appalled about it. You, however, I will scatter among nations, and I will draw out a sword after you as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you are in your enemy's land. The land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it will observe the rest that it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you were living in it. What do we have here? We have here a statement that the length of the captivity would correspond in some way to the Sabbath years that the Israelites didn't keep. Once they got in the land, there's a huge temptation not to let the land rest every 7 years. After all, that was meant that you didn't have as much food that next year. That meant that you didn't get a chance to have another good crop. Maybe the seventh year would be a nice year for crops, and you miss it because you don't plant it. It's a big temptation. And apparently, again and again, through Israelite history, the Israelites did not observe that seventh year. So God said, well, eventually, I will throw you out of the land for your disobedience to the covenant, and the time that I will use to measure this off will be the non-keeping of the Sabbath years. So when Daniel is praying to God, Daniel has been thinking about the 70-year captivity which Jeremiah has predicted, and he, knowing the Old Testament well, I would suggest, was aware of the Leviticus passage, the only passage that gives you any hint for the reason for a length of captivity, that he was thinking about Jeremiah predicting the captivity being 70 years long, and that meant there must have been 70 Sabbath years scattered back through Israelite history. They had not kept his land. And thinking about those seven-year cycles in which the Israelites were supposed to work 6 years and then rested on the seventh, but they hadn't done it. And as a result of that, the Sabbath years of each of those cycles were now being all crunched together and being observed 70 at a shot while he was in Babylon. And so while he's praying to God and confessing sin, an angel comes to him with the message, 70 weeks have been determined upon your holy city and your land to bring an end to these things. My suggestion is that the weeks he's referring to are Sabbath cycles of 7 years, starting 6 years of use of the land and then a 1 year rest of the land. It is interesting that we find this phrase week used also in a writing from the Intertestament period, a book called the Book of Jubilees, which divides up the history of the Israelites into jubilees, 49-year periods, weeks, 7-year periods, and years. So we'll say something like, on the first jubilee, in the third week, in the second year, Adam and Eve got together and they had a son named Cain. And it'll say things like that where it divides up the time by these particular arrangements. I think jubilees is probably the outgrowth of a great interest in the Book of Daniel that occurred during the Maccabean period when Daniel suddenly had some fulfilled prophecies, and people who had been wondering about this book all these years and its strange predictions suddenly saw some things beginning to happen and took a great interest in that thing. Well, what we'd like to do then is now go back into Daniel chapter 9 and look through the passage itself and see what it says before we try and make our calculation. Exegesis is merely a Greek word meaning interpreting, trying to get the interpretation intended by the author of a passage. Let's have a look then at Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 and following. One thing we notice when we get into Daniel chapter 9, particularly when we begin to compare English translations of the passage, is that two rather different interpretations have been suggested for the sequence of events. One of them, which we find in the King James Version, and the New American Standard Bible, and a New International Version, sees that the prediction involves a coming of one Messiah, or one anointed one, after a period of 69 weeks. And we see that clearly in the King James here. So you're to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It shall be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. And then after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off and have nothing. A picture, one Messiah comes at the end of 69 weeks, 7 plus 62 weeks. However, we see a very different situation in some other modern translations. For instance, in the a translation known as the Revised Standard Version in the New English Bible. These, we see, on the other hand, a picture of two anointed ones who are to come, one who is to come after 7 weeks, and one who is to come after a further 62 weeks. Know, therefore, and understand that from the going forth of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Period. Then, for 62 weeks, it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, the anointed one, an anointed one, shall be cut off and have nothing. So here we have a picture of two anointed ones coming, but there's a period of 62 weeks, or 62 times 7 years, or 434 years, I guess that is, between the two, not likely to be the same person. Very different picture there. Which of the two is right? Can we make any choice in that direction? Well, those who hold to two anointed ones separated by a period of 62 weeks will point out the punctuation in the Hebrew Bible. Well, this might look like Greek to you, but it's not. It's Hebrew. The punctuation is that little thing right there underneath that sheen. It looks like this pointer upside down. It looks like that. Okay, it's right down there. That's a punctuation. That says, make a break after 7 weeks, and then do something else with the 62 weeks. However, the punctuation in the Hebrew Bible is nowhere near as old as the Hebrew itself. Here in a standard work on the text of the Old Testament by Wertwein, we see this remark. From this historical survey, he says, it appears that we may reckon with the existence of a fairly constant consonantal text, that is, Hebrew consonants, even from the beginning of the 2nd century A.D., but that the pointing and accents which now appear in the text were only achieved in the 9th and 10th centuries after some hundreds of years of study and of tentative preparatory work. So the case which the RSV and the New English Bible and such build for a strong break between 7 weeks and 62 weeks, and therefore identify the two references to an anointed one as being two different persons, is based on punctuation, which, however, does not go back to the time of the writing of Daniel by well over 1,000 years. Actually, when you look at the passage itself, it's the internal parallelism of the passage suggests very strongly that, in fact, one anointed one is referred to. Here's what the internal parallelism looks like. From the going forth of the word to build again Jerusalem to Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. A reference to building again and a reference to Messiah. Then, as you go down into the passage, there's a reference to building again, and there's a reference to Messiah. Now, if you want to say that there is going to be two comings of anointed ones separated by these 62 weeks, you ought consistently to say there are going to be two rebuildings of Jerusalem separated by some time as well. Rather, it appears from parallelism that we have a summary statement of the matter, and then we begin to have details about it. From the going forth of the word to build again Jerusalem to Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street and wall shall be built again, and after 62 weeks, there's some remarks about could be moat and plaza, and then some remarks about troublous times, and after 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off. My suggestion here is that the reference to 7 weeks, 7:62, which is a rather unusual way of saying 69, is that the building again of the city, the building of the wall, and then the filling up of the city with houses until it's back up to its standard density, is an event that takes something on the order of 49 years. So that these events, speaking of being built again, even in difficult times, is what's going on in the 7 weeks. And then after that 7 weeks is over, there elapses a further 62 weeks to bring you down to the time of the Messiah. So I think on the basis of parallelism, it is not unfair to say that the passage suggests the coming of one anointed one, or Messiah, and he will come after a period of 7 plus 62 weeks. Otherwise, you would consistently have to say there would be two buildings again, which you have no time indicators to indicate when these two are to occur, and have to get yourself into a problem of that sort. Well, what we want to try and do now is ask ourselves, where does this period start from, so that we can figure out where it's going to end? Well, let's look. Starting point. There have been various places suggested for a starting point, but there is one which has a feature that is not matched by any of the others. There is one time at which a command is given, and from that command, the walls of the city of Jerusalem are actually rebuilt, so that it becomes, in ancient terminology, a city again, where the city is rebuilt. That event occurs in connection with the activities of Nehemiah. Nehemiah, who is mentioned here in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 6, had been a high official of the Persian king, Artaxerxes I. He was an official which is called the cupbearer. And that may not sound like a too classy position to you, but the cupbearer is the one who tasted the wine before the king did. And the wine, the king watched him disinterestedly for a couple minutes to see whether he keeled over, and then he handed over. And that doesn't sound like a position for a high official either, but you wanted to be sure that the cupbearer did not taste the wine, savor it, drop something in with a palm of his hand, and hand it over to the king, who then is wiped out by the newly added poison. So it had to be someone the king could trust, and Nehemiah was this person. And Nehemiah had just heard the difficulties in the city. Apparently some of his relatives had gone back earlier, and they had great difficulties with the people around, and so he had wept and fasted and prayed, and then he had to go back on his job, and the king notices he's sad. He says, "What's all this about? You're not sick. This seems to be a sadness of heart." And Nehemiah is very choked up. He's afraid that the king will say, "Off with his head," or something like that. But the king does not. The king is genuinely interested, and Nehemiah tells the troubles here. "Why should my face not be sad?" he says in verse 3. "When the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate, and its gates have been consumed by fire. The king said to me, 'What would you request?' So I prayed to the God of heaven," fast prayer, "and I said to the king, 'If it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it.'" And the king says, "Okay, how long are you going to be going? What will you need?" That sort of thing. And he sets a date. So here is the request to the king that actually leads to the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem after the captivity. And we learn at the beginning of that chapter that the time at which this event occurred was the month Nisan of the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. So here we have, by the standard ancient way of representing time, an indication of the event, the decree, going forth to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. But when was the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king? It was unfortunate that Artaxerxes did not use the AD-BC system, but nobody told him in advance what year BC it was, so he couldn't do much about that. We're stuck in modern times with trying to work out from ancient chronologies how they work into our calendar. This type of work is based upon reading ancient materials and trying to locate eclipses of the sun, eclipses of the moon, things of that variety, particularly eclipses of the sun, and then trying with computers to calculate back when various eclipses should have occurred and where the area of totality would be and things of that variety. And this material, the actual raw material of when those eclipses occurred and such and where they could be seen from, would be found in a work like this at the left, Planetary, Lunar, and Solar Positions from 601 BC to AD 1, published by the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. That type of material is put together in handy form in a work like Jack Finnegan's Handbook of Biblical Chronology. Finnegan says, regarding the activities of Ezra and Nehemiah, "Ezra went to Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes." This was Artaxerxes' first. The year was 458-457 BC, etc. It goes on. And then, down further in this paragraph, "Nehemiah obtained permission to return to Jerusalem in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes," Nehemiah 2:1. If this was Artaxerxes I, the year was 445-444 BC. That is, starts Nisan 445, runs into Nisan 444 BC. He gives a little information on the first day of the month and such, which we really do not need. Here's the starting point then. There have been some suggestions that this might be off a year, 444 BC. As we'll see, that will not make any real difference in our particular calculation here. Here's the starting point. The 20th year of Artaxerxes the king is 445, 444 BC. Now, we have to do the calculation. The passage tells us that from that point to the Messiah, the coming of Messiah the prince, and his being cut off, is 7 plus 62 weeks. Now, many people have just said, okay, that's 7 years times 69, and 7 times 70 is 490, so 7 times 69 must be 483, and they just add 483 years to that. But that's cheating a little bit. Because if we look at the context of this passage, the context suggests that Daniel has been thinking about these Sabbaths that the Israelites had not kept, for which reason they had been in captivity. Now, if that's so, then we're talking about 7-year sabbatical cycles, which have a definite starting and stopping point, just like our weeks have a definite starting and stopping point. Our week starts on Sundays and ends on Saturdays. And you don't start a week in the middle somewhere else. That's the way they function. Well, in fact, we have good evidence that exactly the same thing was done with the sabbatical cycles. We do not know how they decided what year was going to be the first year. Perhaps it was the first year of their entrance into the land of Canaan. Do not know, or the first year they began to farm in the land of Canaan. But whatever it was, it started a cycle which began to run. Now, we do not have information from far enough back to tell how it was running back in the period of the Judges and back in the period of King David and things of that variety. But we do have some information that allows us to calculate where the starting and ending of those sabbatical years was in the so-called Second Temple period, the time from the return of the captivity down to the destruction of Jerusalem, and in fact on off another 400 or 500 years into the AD period when these sabbatical cycles were still being used by people living here and there in the land of Palestine. So we want to try and locate these sabbatical cycles in antiquity. Probably the clearest piece of information we have, or at least the most easily accessible piece of information we have for the location of the sabbatical cycle, is found in the work called First Maccabees. First Maccabees is a historical work telling us about the events from about 168 to about 140 BC, surrounding a time when a Greek king attempted to destroy Judaism, and a small guerrilla band fought back against them, and in the providence of God, they were successful in defeating several large armies, and finally established an independent Israel, which lasted from about 140 BC down to 63 when the Romans took over. During this warfare, in 1 Maccabees chapter 6, verse 49 and following, we find these remarks. When the Jews saw the strength and impetus of the imperial forces, they fell back before them. Part of the king's army marched up to Jerusalem to renew the engagement, and the king put Judea and Mount Zion into a stage of siege. He made peace with the people of Bethsura, who abandoned the town, having no more food to withstand a siege, as it was a sabbatical year when the land was left fallow. Thus the king occupied Bethsura and detailed a garrison to hold it. He then attacked the temple and subjected it to a long siege. He set up emplacements and siege engines with flamethrowers, sounds exciting, and catapults for discharging stones and barbed missiles and slings, but the defendants too constructed engines to counter his engines and put up a prolonged resistance. There was no food, however, in the stores, that would be the storage areas, not the local grocery store, because of the sabbatical year, those who from time to time had arrived in Judea as refugees from the Gentiles had eaten up all that remained of the provisions. There were only a few men left in the temple because the famine had been too severe for them, and they had scattered to their own homes. We see twice in this passage, then, that the ability of the Jews to withstand the coming of this king, Antiochus Epiphanes, was interfered with because they were probably just ending a sabbatical year, and therefore they'd gone a whole year with no crops and had been eating on their stores for nearly 2 years. When did this occur? Just back earlier in the same chapter, 1 Maccabees 6:20, we have this remark. He gathered all the people together to lay siege to the citadel in the year 150. What's that? 150 BC? 150 AD? Neither. It's a year 150 of the Seleucid era, which is what they say in that passage. So you have to figure out what that is. That goes back to when the generals under Alexander, Alexander died a few years earlier, and somehow Alexander's heir had gotten bumped off. So the generals are fighting it out to see who's going to be the heir to Alexander, and the guy Seleucus, who gets a big hunk of the empire, starts an era with his reign. On the basis of that, we find out that there are two possibilities for the proper year in which this siege is going on and they're having trouble with the lack of stores due to sabbatical year. Either the year 163-162 B.C. or the year 162-161 B.C. The complication is we don't know whether the Jews at that period, who, particularly the guy writing First Maccabees, was using a Babylonian or Macedonian calendar, and they start at a different time, and that fouls things up slightly. So within 1 year, we've got possibility. A fellow back in the last century, German fellow back in the last century, then chose one of those 2 years and said, okay, fellows, from now on, we are going to use the cycle that would have this year a sabbatical year, and that would be the year 163-162, a sabbatical year. We're going to have that year be a sabbatical year, and we're going to use that for the new settlers going back to Israel here, late 1800s, okay? And that's what they begin to use. So the traditional Sabbath cycles that you can find mentioned in the Encyclopedia Judaica and such are based upon a calculation made by a German fellow in the last century on this basis. Recently, however, someone has gone back over that material plus other material which has turned up since the 1800s, and done a recalculation. The work done by this fellow appear in the Hebrew Union College Annual of 1973. The Calendar of Sabbatical Cycles During the Second Temple and Early Rabbinic Period by Ben Zion Wachholder. basically, Wachholder goes through a set of 10 pieces of evidence, which we see here in the kind of table of contents. Pledge to keep Shemitah, Alexander exempts the Jews from taxation during Shemitah, Judas Maccabeus defeated Bitzur, ascribed to Shemitah, that's the one we just looked at, the murder of Simon the Hasmonean in 177 A.S., Seleucid era, I believe that is, Herod's conquest of Jerusalem, King Agrippa recites Deuteronomy 7:15 in a post-sabbatical year, and several other things of that variety. He's going down, and his conclusion is, the guy that did the calculation back in the 1800s was a year off. He should have chosen the other year that Maccabees allows for instead of the one he did. And after discussing all of this, Wachholder gives us a table of sabbatical cycles over the whole period. The appendix, a calendar of the sabbatical cycles from 519-18 before the Christian era to 440-441 of the Christian era, or in our parlance, 519-18 B.C., to 440-441 A.D. Well, as we look through these, looking for our starting point, we can do the calculation very easily. Previously, before I ever saw this article, I did the same thing before, and you had a lot of fiddling around with doing calculations and having to remember that 1 B.C. is followed by 1 A.D. without a nice year like zero that us physicists would like in the middle there somewhere. But Wachholder has done it all for us now and made a tabulation of it. So basically, you just go down through the list, and here we see 445, 444, just down at the bottom of the thing there. It's the fifth year of a sabbatical cycle, and even if we happen to be off a year with 444, it would be the sixth year of a sabbatical cycle. It's in a sabbatical cycle. Now, we might be tempted to say, well, we don't count that sabbatical cycle or something like that. Or we figure out the length of sabbatical cycles, and we see how many lengths it is from the starting point to the thing and let it run out that way. But the Jews don't count that way, and very few of the ancients counted that way either. The Jews counted whatever unit they were using. Any part of a unit in calculating a distance was counted as a whole unit. So, for instance, we learn in Scripture that Jesus was crucified on a Friday afternoon. And yet it was said he was 3 days in a tomb, though he rises on a Sunday morning. Part of a Friday, a Saturday, and part of a Sunday counts as 3 days. And that's spoken of both in Scripture as on the third day and after 3 days. We find a very similar sort of situation back in the story of David. He's chasing some people who have plundered his city and carried off the goods and the wives and everything, and they catch up with a fellow that was left behind by the plunderers, one of the guy's servants. And we find that this fellow's been out 3 days and three nights, and it was on the third day that he comes to him. Same sort of a picture of this inclusive counting. Likewise, we see the same thing in the book of Acts, where the situation relating to Cornelius and Peter, the vision that Cornelius has, and he sends his servants to go find this fellow, and he's brought back, etc. When Peter gets back, Cornelius says, 4 days ago to this hour I received the vision, and yet by our way of figuring it would have been 3 days ago to this hour, because we would count three 24-hour periods in between it, but they didn't count that way. They counted the parts of them, and since it was on a certain day, let's say on Tuesday or something, that it happened, and then you have Wednesday and Thursday, and then he arrives a Friday, they count it as 4 days, even though we would only count three 24-hour periods in between it. So, by Jewish method of counting, this sabbatical cycle here that starts in 449 and runs down to 442, starts in the fall, by the way, if you look in the material on the sabbatical year in Leviticus, that would be the first sabbatical cycle. We count that one, 1, 2, 3, 4, on down until you come to the 69th sabbatical cycle, and here it is right here. It is begins in 28 A.D., fall of 28 A.D., and ends in the fall of 35 A.D. Or to put it on a little chart, here's what it looks like. The first sabbatical cycle from 449 to 442 encompasses the command to rebuild Jerusalem in the year 445, the 20th year of Artaxerxes. Running down through these counts, we come to the 69th one, 28 to 35, and what do we suddenly see? But it covers the period of Jesus' ministry, and in fact covers the very period when he was cut off, the standard Jewish term, for putting to death a person who has been charged with a crime. A very striking thing, then, in the biblical material, that the passage that says there would be these 69 weeks, and after the 69th week, and as I pointed out from the biblical material regarding after 3 days and on the third day, the Jewish usage here again is once that day, once that period has started, that is after the 69th week. Once the 69th week has started, after 3 days occurs once that third day has begun. It's after 3 days. And if you run to what we would consider after 3 days, the Jews would say that's after 4 days. The fourth day has started already. Okay? So here we find a rather striking feature, that using a natural interpretation of Daniel, relating it to the background of the events in which Daniel was thinking about and praying about when this message came, we are drawn back to the sabbatical cycles. Using the event in the biblical material in which a command is made to rebuild Jerusalem that actually results in the rebuilding of Jerusalem as a starting point, and counting the Sabbath cycle in which that occurs as the first Sabbath cycle, and using the standard Jewish inclusive method of counting, the 69th cycle brings us right smack on top of the public ministry of Jesus. This, I think, is a very important matter. Not only is Jesus a person who came at the right time, was cut off at the right time, and that's rather definite in the Daniel material, but Jesus is recognized by non-Christians, by persons who in many ways hate Christianity, as one of the most striking figures in human history. Isn't it rather interesting that not only a messianic person came at that very time, but that that person happened to be one of the most striking persons in human history, just happens to show up in the right seven-year period. And though he came, proclaimed as Messiah, his people rejected him and cut him off by bringing him to a capital punishment. That, I think, is a very, very striking thing. We see in Jesus' own response as he heads to Jerusalem for the last time to be cut off by his own people and by the Roman power, that he wept when he saw the city of Jerusalem. Jesus does not enjoy the fact that people are ignoring him, that they ignored him then, that many people ignore him today. He wept over the city of Jerusalem. We find here in Luke chapter 19, it's the triumphal entry, when he approached the city, He was about to ride into the city to proclaim himself Messiah, fulfilling prophecy of Zechariah 9:9. He wept over the city, saying, "If you had known in this day, even you, the things that make for peace, but now they're hidden from your eyes. For days shall come upon you when your enemies will throw up a bank before you, surround you, and hem you in on every side. They will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation." It's rather interesting. I don't know that I want to make any big case about it. The Jews did not recognize the time of their visitation. The materials were available to them. I doubt that they could have calculated the ending of the 69, or the exact time of the 69th cycle within a year or so. I don't know that for sure. But they certainly could have calculated within a cycle or two when it should have occurred. They should have been very much on the lookout. In fact, the impression you get is they were on the lookout, that there was a great interest in the coming of the Messiah during this period. But the one person who falls in that period, the one person who, according to the biblical material, and even according to the Talmud, was working miracles in this period, was the very person that the Jews turned away from. We need to be concerned ourselves, lest in seeing a material like this, we say, "Boy, that was a lucky guess," or "Boy, you sure bent those passages, didn't you?" or something of that variety. I would recommend that if you think I've done anything shifty with these passages, you study the matter for yourself. Best of my knowledge, and I've studied the thing over fairly carefully, as I said before, this passage using sabbatical cycles does something that the biblical material actually would suggest was going on there, and use the term weeks in the context of Daniel's own prayer. That the starting place is the very place where the actual decree is made that leads to the building of Jerusalem. That the count is by the method of counting used by the Jews in their all of their calculations we know about. For instance, royal reigns. A royal reign of a king starts when he comes to the throne, but his first year of reign is that year that starts whenever the new year starts. They will count back then from his own year to start that first year of his reign. When the next new year comes, it's the second year of his reign, even though he hadn't been reigning a year. It might have only been reigning a day. That's his second year, et cetera, going on. Standard Jewish way of counting. That comes down right smack on Jesus' public ministry. We need to be concerned, then, that these materials of the Bible pictures are something more than ancient men groping around after God, something more than some fanatics who saw some slick magic work by Jesus and decided he was somebody great, like persons may have thought of Father Divine, or persons may have thought of Jimmy Jones, or someone like that. Here is a person, even recognized today as an impressive thinker in the areas of ethics, a person who's had an impact on history to match anyone, and yet he came at the very time that this particular prophecy suggested. I don't know whether there are any here tonight who are not Christians, but only willing to listen to and consider the evidences for Christianity. We've tried to look at one evidence for Christianity tonight, a moderately complicated one, but one which indeed is real. It's really there. Alternative attempts to deal with it. Liberals have an alternative attempt to deal with it. They try to have the whole book of Daniel written in 168 B.C. and try to then make this passage end at 168 B.C. Unfortunately, by any possible dates that they can scrounge up for the going forth of a command to rebuild Jerusalem, and the earliest one I can think of you can even work on is an implied command when the city of Jerusalem is destroyed in 587, you miss by 50 years getting the time to run out at 168 B.C., whereas the biblical material point very definitely to the very time of Jesus Christ. I would urge you not to treat religion as a matter of indifference, not to say, "Well, I want to wait around till I find a religion I like." That's a dangerous business. If religions really are supposed to be talking about what is and what we ought to be and what life is all about, then there's only going to be one religion that's right. Now, that religion may be something no one's ever discovered yet, but I don't think that's correct. I think when we begin to look at the evidences that have been brought forward for religions that are discussed among men today, Christianity has got all the others beat on the matter of evidences. The vast majority of religions around today talk about faith of some variety, and by it they mean a leap in the dark. Great leap. There are even many Christians that talk that way. But the biblical picture of faith is not a leap in the dark. It's a dependence upon someone who has given evidence he can be trusted. That someone is the author of the Bible, the ultimate author of the Bible, the one who has in the Bible evidence that he knows the end from the beginning, that he controls what comes to pass in history. And that evidence has been so designed in the Bible that it points to one particular person in history, Jesus, and says, this one, pay attention to him. He is who he claims to be. He is indeed God. How can man become God? He did it for a very important reason. Man was made to obey God. Man was made to love God with all his heart and mind and soul. And man was made to love his neighbor as himself. But men don't do that. And men don't do that because man originally turned away from God, intentionally messed up the situation. And we've inherited that intentional mess. We do what we want, more or less, within the range of not having other people trample on us too much. We do what we want, but we find we can't do things that we really ought to do. The very principles that we use to condemn others when they do things to us, we find ourselves doing those very same things. The Bible says this is what we call sin. That man has got a nature within him that is not able to avoid sinning. And the trouble is, even though at times he wants not to, when the crucial point comes, he doesn't want not to enough to not do it. One of my problems is weight, eating too much. I'm very good at dieting between meals, actually between meals and between snacks. When the food's not there, it's easy to diet. But when the food's there, it kind of reaches out at you. It grabs a hold of you. It forces you to eat it. Not quite, but something irrational seems to be going on. That is, in fact, I think, a picture of a problem that man has. Man's drives are out of control. And although men might like to be better, they can't do it. That's why God became a man. God became a man for several reasons. First of all, he became a man in order that he might provide the kind of righteousness we're supposed to provide but don't. That he might love God with all his heart and mind and soul. That he might love his neighbors himself. Jesus came to provide the righteousness we couldn't provide. And to do that, he had to be a man by human righteousness. But he also came to take the punishment that we couldn't take. He was able in a short time on the cross to suffer the punishment that would take us forever to suffer. If we trust in him, the righteousness he provided will take the place, the righteousness we ought to have provided, be applied to our account, so to speak. If we trust in him, the punishment that he took will take the place of the punishment we deserved. If we trust in him, God will do something inside us that begins to change us. And we will begin to be like we wanted to be. And we'll begin to want to be like we ought to want to be. We're going to begin to see changes take place inside us. We're going to begin to line up with what God intended us to be. And since God made us, he knows what makes us tick, the best sort of way we could possibly tick. Are you unhappy? Are things not working well? Do you find emptiness in your life? No meaning? The reason for that is that man's meaning comes from God. And we can't have the meaning that he intended, the emptiness within us filled, unless we're willing to let him fill it. That's the offer God has for you tonight. And he, in his goodness, has given us these kind of evidences, such as we looked at here in Daniel 70 weeks, to show us that we don't need to take a leap in the dark. We don't need to spend our life wandering from religion to religion, trying to find something that will satisfy. Wandering from pleasure to pleasure, trying to find something to satisfy. We can trust him, and we will begin to see that it will satisfy, it will change us, that we'll become the kind of people that we really did want to be inside after all, though we hardly knew it ourselves. Be glad to talk to you, any of you privately, if you would like, regarding how you can find Jesus as the one who would bear your sins, the one who would bring you back to God, the one who would give you meaning in life that you can really find in no other way. Thank you.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog, or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, 19440.